Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, nutritional studies are vital to the world of sports. The right nutrients can optimise an athlete's performance, reduce their risk of injury, and help them get the most out of training. But traditionally, research on nutrition for female athletes has been lacking. Despite their incredible achievements and contributions to sports, a review from the University of Chester suggests that just 6% of sports science research has focused specifically on female athletes. Now, that figure is even more shocking when you consider just how popular women's sport is. 49% of athletes at the last Olympic Games in Tokyo were female, while 50 million people around the world tuned in to watch the England women's football team win the Euros last year. All of this makes it even more important to grow the body of research so that the increasing number of women in sport are not underserved by it. So, what exactly is the role of nutrition in women's sports? How does it differ to men's sports? And how can we encourage more studies in this area? With me to discuss this are two absolutely fantastic guests. Vari Keel is Senior Performance Nutritionist at the UK Sports Institute. Hello there, Vari.
Hi, thanks very much for having me. Looking forward to having a chat with you.
Great to have you with us, yeah. And Rini McGregor is a sports dietitian, author and co-founder of Train Brave, which raises awareness of eating disorders in sport. Hello there, Rini.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Fantastic to have you as well. Now, so little of sports science research is focused on female athletes. So Rini, how have you gone about navigating female-specific sports science if there is such a lack of research? I mean, do you have to just take a bit of a guess, have an opinion instead?
It's a really good question. And to answer that question, to a certain degree, exactly what you said. I mean, I think as someone who's been in the field for over 20 years, you learn a lot about human physiology, human behaviour. You read all the science in terms of general health and information for females, but you also try a lot out. So, you know, I've worked in numerous different areas of sports nutrition, and particularly with different athletes. You know, I've worked with gymnastics, I've worked with disability athletes, I've worked with ballet now, I've worked with runners, triathletes, you name it. So you get a big kind of group and population with who you learn from in your own way. So while the questions may not have been asked within sports science, you're asking the questions within your own practice. And that's what makes a good practitioner, is somebody who's always curious and always asking questions and using that information to inform their own practice. So a lot of the observations that are being seen in women, I've probably seen for many, many years, and use that information to deliver my own practice with the athletes I've worked with. So, you know, you might start with what information is out there through sports science, and then you test it and you get the feedback and you review it, and then you find the right approach for that person, as well as knowing all the information around female physiology and hormones. And to a certain degree, being a female in your own right helps you with that to a certain degree, because you are wanting to understand your own body. And so that gives you that sort of insight into, well, actually, you know, I know that the physiology of a female is very different to that of a male, and hormones affect us in very different ways. And so actually, do I need to think about that when I'm providing this information? So it has been a little bit of trial and error, a little bit of extrapolating data, but also asking as many questions as you can from with what is available, and also learning as you go along.
Now, Vari, women's representation in sport is seeing dramatic changes, both in terms of investment and in popularity. I live really near the Arsenal ground, and I'm much more excited by the women's team than the men's. I know I'm not the only one around here. So why is research still lacking?
Yeah, I think actually it's a really hot topic right now, and there's a lot of energy and movement in this space. And inevitably, there's going to be a lag between recognising that there is an absence of information to being able to produce that scientific research. So when you look at the science space, you know, people have to set up research projects, they have to get the funding, they have to set up the projects, they have to collect the data, and then they have to produce the article, the research article, and get it published. So that just takes time. So we're going to experience a bit of a lag. But even, you know, just this morning, I saw a tweet from Professor Stuart Phillips, showing low energy availability and its impact on myofibrillar and sarcoplasmic protein synthesis. So showing basically that low energy intakes will impair your muscle adaptations and repair process. So there is research being done in this space, and we've got a lot of really good hubs of research just within the UK alone, let alone, you know, other countries that are focusing in on this space and producing some really good information and good research. But it's just going to take a bit of time for us to be able to see all of that come to fruition. But I think there's a lot of things that are going on in this space that maybe are less well known about. So in the UK Sports Institute, we have a designated female athlete health team, and they have projects going on looking at the hormones of specific athletes who are experiencing challenges in this space to establish their hormones, their menstrual cycle, to be able to give more specific individualised support for the athlete and the practitioners that are working with that athlete to be able to enhance their support that they provide to them. There's also work going on with Nationwide Pathology Labs and iron deficiency anemia. There's a collaboration with University of Portsmouth and the work that they do in this space on bra and breast health. And there's collaborations with the UK Sports Institute research and innovation team. So one of the sports that I work with, British Gymnastics, we have a partnership or a project going with our UK Sports Institute research and innovation team, looking at the apparel and how this can be enhanced to better support female athletes, female gymnasts. So, and I know that's happening in other sports as well. So I think there's pockets of work going in within sports. There's pockets of work going in within different institutes across different countries. There are lots of bits of work, and there's a lot of energy and a lot of movement in this space. Yeah, things probably less published, but there is work going on, and we have some good collaborations going on across institutes and across sports. So yeah, fingers crossed we'll just see more and more movement and more publications come through that will help inform our practice.
Yeah. So Rini, it's probably not simple to answer this question, but in general, what tend to be the nutritional needs of female athletes, and how do they differ from the needs of male athletes?
I mean, it is a very difficult question to answer because it does depend on what they're doing. So it depends on the sport, it depends on the training load, it depends on the training volume, it depends on training age. So everybody you work with, you have to kind of start from scratch and do a full sort of assessment of what their needs are. But how we differ from men is that our physiology is very, very different. Like I said earlier, like we are governed quite strongly by a menstrual cycle, which has sort of fluctuating hormonal levels all the time. And although at the moment there is not enough science to say that, you know, you need to do X on this day and Y on this day, we definitely don't have that science. We do know that the hormones have an impact on how we feel, how we respond, and also generally that they can make us, you know, feel more fatigued at certain times of the month and all those sorts of things. So you have to take all that into consideration. But I think one of the biggest challenges with a female athlete is the pressure they feel, whether that's coming from the sport themselves, whether that's coming from the fact that athletes tend to be a certain personality type and do have very high standards and expectations of themselves. But the kind of the pressure they put in terms of body aesthetic and body composition, and not always having fully being educated on their nutritional needs, means that a lot of the challenges I see and a lot of the work, I'd say probably 90% of the work I do, is working with individuals who tend to underconsume and particularly don't have sufficient knowledge on the types of nutrient they need to be eating at certain times around their training load as well. So, you know, Vari mentioned REDS. This is the area I tend to specialize in, and we work with a lot of people who present with REDS and low energy availability. And so this is definitely a big challenge. But equally, you know, take that out of it, you'll have to think about the fact that we also have different micronutrient needs too. So, you know, looking at things like iron specifically, or looking at magnesium or vitamin D or omega-3. So it is a complex picture. It's not as simple as, okay, well, we know you need this many calories, and so this is what we have to deliver. It's actually looking at, well, these are your energy requirements. This is also the energy availability you need. And now let's look at your own sort of specific phenotype, genotype, and then put that all into play to create something that's a little bit more, I suppose, bespoke for them.
I just wanted to jump in on this because I think it's really a really interesting area. Just it can appear quite simple when you say what's the nutritional differences between a male and female, and I think from the experience I've had in the sports that I've worked in, it's looking at the whole picture of what that individual is going through in the transition. So when I think about gymnastics specifically, they go through some really key transitions. So puberty would be one major transition, and it's the impact that these have on their psychology and their emotional status that then will influence their nutritional practices, which then impacts the differences between a male and a female quite significantly. Yeah. So, you know, for a female in a sport like gymnastics, and there are other sports, you know, skating and diving, where they become elite at a very early age. And so this process of puberty, which has huge changes on their body, you know, we increase in body fat, our body shape changes, we develop breasts. And that has such a knock-on impact on your ability to perform the sport. Yeah. And so, you know, with the challenges there, there can be a loss of performance, and there's a difficulty because it takes time to be able to come through that, adapt the strength, adapt to your new body type, which males don't necessarily experience, because puberty brings on, you know, an increase in muscle and an increase in strength that generally works in their favour for the sport. So females have that to navigate, and in a sport like gymnastics where they're elite at such an early age and they're competing on the international stage, you've got the pressures then that social media are bringing in, and the video footage and the photos. So they have this hugely personal experience that is now on display for everyone to see in their leotard, the whole world to comment on. So I think there's two really big pieces there. There's the challenges around that and their psychology and their emotional status. And then there's the challenges around the temporary loss of performance and how they bring that back and they develop the strength and give themselves time in a sport where they always feels like there isn't enough time because they're doing such complex work at such an early age. And when they can't do the complex skills, they've just got to wait until they can, as opposed to another sport where, you know, you can keep on running. But gymnastics, you can't keep on doing complex skills, you know, when your body won't allow you to do that. So it's a really big challenge. And I think that then has such a big impact on their decisions, their nutritional decisions, how they are emotionally and psychology, which then has another impact on it. So I think there's a big difference between males and females in that sense.
Yeah. It's such a complex area, isn't it? So, Vari, I mean, one thing female athletes may have to consider is navigating the menstrual cycle as well. So not just the hormonal changes of life stages, but, you know, a monthly change. What is the link between nutrition and menstruation? And what has to be taken into account when curating diet plans for athletes and you know, considering their periods? This may be a naive question, but are there hormonal fluctuations that are important enough that they need tackling separately for different athletes?
Yeah, so, you know, our menstrual cycle is such an important indicator of health for females. So fundamentally, it's a key physiological cyclical process that is driven by your hormones. But these hormones, you know, they're not just about reproductive function. They're about cardiovascular health, immune health, bone health, muscle repair and muscle function. And often we see menstrual cycle as a challenge and as a negative, and it's such a hassle to have to go through. But actually, there's so many benefits to having your menstrual cycle. And so we need those hormones to help us adapt to training, to build the muscle tissue, to build strong bones, to develop the resilience and manage the mechanical load that we put our bodies through. So our menstrual cycle is hugely important, but these are driven by a number of factors. So, you know, some of those hormones that drive the menstrual cycle are produced in an area of our brain, and that can be affected by, you know, sleep and our stress levels, how much exercise we're doing. But it's also fundamentally affected by our nutrition, and the biggest driver there is our energy consumption. So we talk about energy availability, which is the amount of energy that's available to the body to sustain physiological processes once you've taken out the energy taken off to do exercise, your training. So what's left to maintain all the physiological processes in the body? And if your energy consumption and or your energy expenditure is, your energy expenditure is too high, your energy consumption is too low, then you can be in this state where you've just got this low energy availability. And so the body has to shut down a process. And in females, the first process it does shut down to conserve energy is the menstrual cycle. And so we lose our menstrual cycle, we lose the hormones, and then the benefits that these hormones bring to supporting bone strength, supporting muscle repair. So it's a huge factor when you're considering a nutritional plan. what is this individual doing? What stage of their life are they in? Have they started a menstrual cycle? If they haven't, then why haven't they? What age are they? What are the genetics? What are they going through from a training perspective? How much energy is required to support that? Which is always the, everyone wants to know that the answer to that question, how much energy do I need? And that's such a hard question to answer when you don't know how much energy a specific individual is burning, depending on the training, the type of training, the intensity, their muscle mass, their genetics. You know, it's a really complex area to really work out, but it is a key factor that we have to look at. And then we do have a challenge with athletes who might take use contraception. If they're taking contraceptive medication, then and you don't have a true cycle, then you don't know when you've lost that cycle, and you don't know therefore what the impact of energy is and how you might be able to build that energy, because you don't know necessarily there's a problem because they aren't having a natural cycle to for us to feed off and understand. If we track that, does that give us information about their health and their status? So yeah, we have to consider their cycle, we have to consider energy consumption largely. And if someone is on a low energy intake, then the chances are their whole nutrient intake is going to be compromised as a result of that.
Yeah.
Can I just add as well? I think, like, I'm just adding on to what Vari was saying, is when you talk about the kind of energy used for training, it's all movement. So obviously, if they're younger and they're also doing additional sports at school, or they, you know, they're older and they may be commuting to their sessions, all of that, the body doesn't differentiate between training and movement. So it is, you know, what I find with particularly like certain athletes, and they don't take into consideration the energy they need for all that additional movement as well. They just take into consideration what they're doing for training. And that can often be one of the reasons why you get this disparity between energy intake and energy availability and you know, what's kind of left over. So I think, like, it's exactly what Vari said, but it's just adding that extra bit in to realize that it's more than just training. Mm. It's all movement that needs to be counted.
Yeah. And Rini, research from the late 90s showed that many female athletes would avoid dietary fat, especially if they're interested in weight loss at the same time. Now, as well as fats, carbohydrates are also often demonized, with diets like the keto diet receiving a huge amount of attention. In your experience, does any of this ring true for female athletes now? Are the same kind of dynamics still at work here? And how do you make sure that your clients are getting enough of the right nutrients?
So I think it depends on what you're reading and also what level you are training at. So the individuals that Vari will work with at that very high performance, high elite level, they, you know, they have access to nutritionists, performance nutritionists. So they should be provided with the right information. That's not to say they'll always follow it, but they should be provided with the right information. I think where it becomes a bit more complicated is when you're looking at slightly bigger audience and bigger population of females, particularly who are more recreational or more kind of competitive level, but don't have that elite level support system, because they will be getting their information from the likes of social media. They will be influenced by the kind of, you know, health influencer and the fitness influencer and the people that are putting information out on social media, where there may be much more leaning towards demonizing food groups. So we definitely see, you know, in our clinic, we definitely 100% see women following very low carb diets because they've been told that's a way for them to adapt to more endurance sport. We also get women who fear carbohydrate because this common theme of carbohydrate is what makes you put on weight, and you should only be using carbohydrate when you're training, not necessarily all the way around. And we definitely see this in our clinic, and a big piece of the education we do in our clinic is helping women to realize that carbohydrates are so very important and necessary, particularly for that menstrual cycle. Absolutely, these food fads that we see and these food fads that are being kind of put out there are affecting what women choose to eat and how they choose to eat. I think also it doesn't help when there's a lot of information out there based on health. So we've got obviously things like the Zoe study, where we're looking at sort of health metrics and a different population group. But then you've got a big population group of people who want to stay fit and healthy and maybe not compete at an elite level, but are still competing at a high level within their sport. And the lines get blurred. And so people start to follow this health, I suppose, health propaganda, health publications, rather than looking at, well, what's relevant to me? I'm actually training 9-10 hours a week. And, you know, does that apply to me? Should I be taking on that information, or should I be, how do I do that? So I think there are definitely challenges working in this field, and particularly working against the noise that is out there. But a lot of it does depend on what sport you're doing and what your goal is going to be, but also what level you train at as to where you get that information from.
Gotcha. Okay. Vari, is there something you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, I think, you know, what Renee's saying is really true, that it's hard for athletes to separate the messages they're getting from social media around, you know, nutrition for specific individuals, and that might be nutrition for aesthetics and people who aren't doing the volume or intensity of training that, you know, we see a lot of the athletes that we work with doing. But I think there's a really big piece around, you know, carbs are demonized, fats are demonized, but people don't pull apart the quality of what they're consuming there. And it's,
gotcha,
it's looking at, you know, carbs as a whole incorporates quite a lot of foods. So, you know, 50 grams of carbs from sweet potato or brown rice, and, you know, the less processed forms of carbohydrates, very different to 50 grams of carbohydrates that you get from heavily processed carbohydrates. That might be, you know, sweets or chocolate or crisps or, you know, even white bread. So the nutrient composition, the fiber composition, the micronutrient intake that you're going to get from these different carbohydrates is very different. And the impact that they'll have on the body, you know, on our hormones, our insulin levels, and the knock-on impact that that has is so different. And the same is true for fats, you know, avocado, oily fish versus deep fat fried foods or heavy packaged foods that've got lots of trans fats. And the same true for proteins. So, you know, we can lump it into carbohydrates, but you've got to separate out the good carbohydrates, the ones that are going to give you quality nutrients, quality forms of carbohydrates, versus the heavily processed forms. And I think that's an important piece.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think it is really important, but I think we also have to be really careful with the fact that some of the, again, going on what Vari was saying with the carbohydrate, is that you've also got fruits and vegetables in that carbohydrate mix. And while those are important in terms of providing fiber and nutrients for an athlete population or people who are physically very active, if you fixate on just eating those as your source of carbohydrates as well, then that can displace energy availability. And again, something that we observe a lot is a lot of young, we work with a lot of young athletes coming in who are so fearful of having bread or pasta because of the messages that are out there, but they will happily eat carrots and butternut squash and all, you know, kind of these sort of more root vegetables as their source of carbohydrate, but then they're not delivering the actual carbohydrate needs that they have for the amount of training they're doing. So again, that education around food is really critical. And what I hear from schools is it's still not taught particularly well, in terms of, you know, a lot of food is often demonized in schools as well, about, well, this is bad and this is good. And we definitely need to move away from that terminology. And I know in dietetics, we try and talk a lot more about nutrient dense foods and what they deliver and how they support the body, rather than sort of trying to demonize things. But how you get away from that messaging when there's so much information out there and poor and misinformation out there is a complicated, a very, very complicated conversation, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, now my last question is really to both of you. Just very briefly, I want to take us back to the initial introduction where we were talking about the amount of research. I mean, what can we do to make women's sports science as abundantly researched and well-funded as men's sports science? And I appreciate what you're both saying, that there is a lot of research in the pipeline that has been initiated and has yet to come out, but there presumably is still a gap. How can we encourage more research? Vari, perhaps you could start.
Yeah, I think it's about having these conversations. It's keep asking the questions, keep having the conversations, keep promoting it. And we're, you know, the more and more we're getting lots of successful teams, female athletes come through, and it's being recognised. Yeah. And that raises the platform considerably. And I think it's just keeping that momentum and keeping the energy behind it. And the more questions we ask as practitioners and understand that, you know, we would really like an answer in this specific area, the more we can help inform and drive maybe what some of the research does. And we have those links there with our institutes of sport, yeah, and we link in with the universities to have that sort of connection and a bit of a two-way process that we can help support them and the students coming through and in access to the athletes to get the research done, but also they can support us in trying to answer some of the questions that we might have. So it's just keeping the discussions live.
Yeah, absolutely. Renee, what are your opinions on this? How can we encourage more research into women's sports science?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. It's about any sports science, whether it's women's sports science or any sports, but any research, you have to actually ask the right question. And I think sometimes we're not even asking the right question. But I also think, you know, we need to also increase the diversity in terms of who we're researching. So women, but actually different age groups in women, different backgrounds in women, because again, everything has a part to play. So I think absolutely practitioners need to keep asking questions. We need to keep having these conversations. We need to keep showcasing that women are different to men and demonstrate that as much as we can. We need to stop having taboo around women-specific issues. Like, I know there's so much more now information and so many more female athletes coming forward talking about, you know, I was on my period when I was competing and you know, that had an impact on how I felt and how I trained and how I performed. And I think those conversations need to keep happening, and men and women need to not kind of feeling like they've got to sort of stay clear of certain topics.
Fantastic. Well, all hugely enlightening, and I hope that we start to see a big change in the very near future, because it sounds like it's badly needed. So, Vari Keel and Renee McGregor, thank you so much for joining me. I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, we'd like you to join us in our new initiative, Sustainable Food Week, where we're celebrating the influential people changing the future of food. There are a number of ways to get involved. We've got a digital digest, an in-person forum, and podcast opportunities. It's happening between the 18th and 24th of September. But if you want to be involved, you need to act now. Find out more on the Food Matters Live website or email us at info@foodmatterslive.com. And thank you so much for listening.